Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donald on a Kitchen show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prigentas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio. Well, here we are in Iowa. We're the center of the country, center of Iowa, and we are in the center of much large-scale agriculture. As Donna says, we are kind of in the middle of the belly of the beast here. And as human beings, whether we farm or not, we seek to find meaning about our everyday existence. We tell ourselves stories. To kind of help us get along. And we tell ourselves stories all the time. We say this is the land of the free, the home of the brave. We say a penny saved is a penny earned. We say go Cyclones, beat the Hawkeyes. And these things are not just words. They say a lot about us. And we also, for many, many years, we've been saying Iowa feeds the world. The stories we tell ourselves affect our lives. Joining us at the kitchen table today is Dr. Andrea Rissing. Welcome to our table, Andrea.
I want to do a little introduction. Andrea is, her main study is in the Department of Environmental Sciences. She's a postdoc at the at Emory University in Atlanta. She wrote her PhD on a lot of research that she did in Iowa, which is how we got to know her. She describes her work intersecting critical agrarian studies, political economy, and economic anthropology. I like that. Economic anthropology.
Yes, yes. Also, we also became aware of Andrea because there was this article that kind of popped up, and it caught my eye and Donna's too. It was called... The title of the article is We Feed the World, the Political Ecology of the Corn Belt's Driving Narrative. Yeah, think about that. All right.
Yeah. This is Andrea's published article. So, Andrea, tell us how you sort of began to focus on this particular narrative.
Yeah, well, thank you both so much for having me. It's a real honor to be on the Donna Lana Kitchen show, which I listened to quite a bit when I was living in Ames. And how did I start to think about We Feed the World? Lana, I really liked what you were saying about, you know, the stories we tell ourselves. So I'm in the Department of Environmental Sciences now, but I'm actually trained as a cultural anthropologist. And when I came, well, I have a long history in Iowa, but when I came to Iowa specifically to do this this research, you know, I was doing what's called ethnographic research. So that means that I was spending a lot of time with people in their daily lives, and I was driving around a whole bunch of different types of farms across the whole state of Iowa, and I was working with farmers on their farms. I was going to farmers markets to sell with farmers there. I was just trying to participate in, the social fabric of Iowa's agriculture.
So, and, like any good anthropologist, you're hanging out with the local tribes.
Exactly. Man, and Iowa agriculture is tribal. That's real. That's a good word. But an interesting thing about this project, right, so I was focused mostly on folks who were in, you know, kind of broad strokes could be described as direct marketers. So they were selling to local markets. Like I said, I was going to farmers markets, and folks were running community-supported agriculture or CSA farms. They were selling to people who live in Iowa. But I kept hearing this story, We Feed the World. This was something that from like the earliest days of my fieldwork, I was writing those three words, feed the world, feed the world, feed the world, across all of my notebooks, and it just kept coming up in conversations where I would hear it on the radio or I would hear it in presentations that I was at. And I was thinking, you know, this is kind of incongruous because the folks who I'm working with aren't really feeding the world. They're not exporting their products to other countries. They're selling it to their neighbors.
Feed the local population.
Exactly. They feed their communities. But this kind of omnipresent story, you know, that Iowa feeds the world, that Iowa is the breadbasket of the world, it was just everywhere. And, you know, as an anthropologist, I try to pay attention to things that I hear over and over and over again. And so I started to think more carefully about what it means for a state to say that it feeds the world, and started to pay attention to, you know, the different places that I heard people repeat those words, and kind of the different forms that it took and the different effects or consequences that I could start to see it having as it intersected different people's lives and the way that they thought about their agricultural work. So really, I think I started to think about it the way anybody does, if I just heard it a lot. You guys hear it a lot, too?
Yeah. So how does this phrase, Iowa feeds the world, affect our lives? I mean, sure, we can put it on T-shirts. That's fine. But it kind of seems to find its way into – people kind of get taken aback by things. It seems to end many conversations. What have you found out in that regard?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like it's used in a lot of different ways, right? So in the article that you guys talked about, I make kind of a three-part argument where I do this tracing of the story across different, you know, types of spaces. So I talk about how it came up in interviews that I did with agricultural bankers or with other types of agricultural professionals, as well as farmers. And I say that when people in, you know, Iowa agriculture say we feed the world, it has three effects. The first one is that it is defending industrial agricultural systems against criticisms. So, you know, industrial ag is subject to a lot of critiques these days along economic, social, environmental lines, and saying, you know, well, you know, saying, like, meeting those critiques by saying, but we feed the world, like you say, it can kind of end a conversation.
It puts this moral imperative behind the whole thing where you... Right. If you accuse somebody of not wanting to feed the world, that's not good.
Yeah, I am kind of reminded of way back in the middle of the last century, there was a white guy comedian. How was it? I don't know. But there was this classic line of, "Have you stopped beating your wife?" I mean, it's what do you say to something like that? Well, Henny Youngman, I don't know. Any one of those guys, anyway. But it's one of those, well, all right. How can you argue with that? All right. You said there was three things that this affects.
Yep, exactly. So that's the first one, is it's a defense, and then you just kind of started to anticipate the second one, which is that it justifies the pursuit of yield, of ever higher yields, basically on moral grounds.
Yeah, so, and yield exactly being like the only value, right?
Exactly. Yep. Wow. It's this idea that more yields are always better because, you know, there's hungry people around the world. We need to grow more. So it's bringing this moral angle in to what I call, or what I think of as, kind of the yield-centric accounting of agriculture, where mostly we're paying attention to, you know, well, what was your bushel per acre? What was the bushel per acre? Like this way of talking about agricultural success that centers on yield. So it defends industrial ag against criticisms. It's justifying, you know, the pursuit of ever higher yields by bringing it, you know, into a moral framework. And then the last piece that I argue specifically around how it intersected with the more alternative, smaller scale direct market farmers that I was working with is that I say that it gatekeeps agricultural legitimacy, or that it can kind of, in both ways, subtle and overt, you know, can kind of work to delegitimize small scale local agriculture. And this became most clear to me when the farmers who I was working with would say things like they would go to meetings or talk to you know, neighbors or folks at the store, and they would hear things like, you know, you can't feed the world farming like that. And they were like, I'm not trying to feed the world, you know, I'm running a farmer's market.
Trying to feed my community,
you know,
right?
Exclusively.
Exactly.
That's not even part of my, I'm not even trying to. Why is this a critique that's being levied at me when I'm not even trying to do this?
Well, now that reminds me of another saying that I was raised with by my mother, which was, charity begins at home, which sounds like if you feed your neighbors, maybe that's where feeding the world can start. I want to put this in a real contemporary context. And then Andrea's going to talk about this history of how we got to this sort of place. But, just this last week, it was last Thursday, as a matter of fact, Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack announced that the United States will launch, quote, a coalition for productivity growth. Does that sound like we need more of that? Anyway, to promote the use of high-tech ag tools such as gene editing, precision agriculture to build a more, quote, sustainable food system. The coalition would stand in contrast to the European Union's farm-to-fork strategy of greatly reducing the use of fertilizers and pesticides and putting 25% of European farmland into organic production. So I was kind of happy to see this at least, because the EU for a long time, it has been the EU and the US in conjunction promoting, you know, we will feed the world. And now the EU is diverging more towards, you know, these kinds of more local strategies. So this is an ongoing story. Andrew, you want to explain the history of where, how we got to this point?
I can try. It's a fairly complicated.
Yeah, but you did a great job in the paper, I have to say. It was very clearly clearly laid out where you talked about was rooted in the 20th century histories of the U.S. export-oriented food regimes. So, I mean, we're not, let's be clear, the corn that we are growing here in Iowa and most of the soybeans as well is not used for food primarily. So we're not really feeding the world with this. So how did we arrive at this point with this saying of we are feeding the world when actually we are not feeding the world? Most of the corn goes for, what did you say, 40% for ethanol, 30-some percent for animal feed, and then a small portion for things that are, like, made into corn syrup and the kind of the cheaper obesity-inducing ingredients in our daily diet. So how did we get here?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I was glad that you sent me the Vilsack quote. That's from, I believe those were from the remarks that he made at the G20 Open Forum on Sustainability, saying that the U.S. was calling for people to join their coalition for sustainable productivity growth. And then this coalition for sustainable productivity growth, like you said, was opposed to the European Union's farm-to-fork strategy, where they were trying to account for some other things like, you know, the fairness of food, the health of food, the environmental.
The health of the agricultural land.
Right, exactly. And try to bring in more, try to intentionally aim towards more organic production. And I thought that was a really apt quote or, you know, piece of ag news to pull out, because it's this interesting thing where I think it sounds really new and it sounds like this cutting edge thing, but it's actually, you know, it's echoing this really long-standing
with
the oldest story in ag, in U.S. ag. We spent some 70 years maximizing productivity. So thinking about the history, I mean, right, just to, like, say it up front, the United States is the global leader in agricultural exports. Since 1960, the U.S. has been a net exporter of agricultural products, which means, right, obviously, that we're shipping out more ag products than we're importing. And I think last year was actually the second highest year on record, for agricultural exports. So we're, you know, at least we're kind of walking the talk. We say we feed the world, and we are very good at exporting a lot of ag commodities.
Right, which are not necessarily food, right?
Or, right, yeah.
And it's also been used as part of our you know, it's a strategy, not, it's not a humanitarian strategy. It's a power structure strategy. We have been offering, instead of offering, like it started, some of the Marshall Plan, for example, after World War II, you could either help a country rebuild its agriculture infrastructure, or you could just unload your commodities on them, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And that caused the collapse, further collapse of a lot of local markets. But it also left the U.S. in the dominant position. Here, we are feeding you. We are controlling your, the economy of your, you know, your food goods. It's a...
Yeah, I think you're really right to...
It's a military application, basically.
Funny about that. I'd like to break in.
Really.
Yeah, I'd like to break in here and remind folks that this is KHOI and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. We will be back with to talk more with Andrea Rissing. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about one of the, as probably a cultural anthropologist would say, a narrative, what we tell ourselves about what we are doing. We're talking about Iowa Feeds the World with Dr. Andrea Rissing, and she wrote a paper called We Feed the World, the Political Ecology of the Corn Belt's Driving Narrative. Let's talk about how we got here, more of this.
So, Andrea, this all revolves, obviously, we have not mentioned yet farming subsidies. So the history of farming subsidies, how did we get into this kettle of fish or basket of corn?
How did we get into this basket of corn? Donna, I think you were really right to kind of point right before the break to that post-World War II period, right? So when I think about the history of U.S. ag and ag policy and ag technologies, you know, that time right after World War II really was a really important time where we can trace a lot of the, you know, roots of our current moment or our current, you know, landscapes and regimes to that, you know, 1945 into the 1950s period. So we came out of World War II, right? And this is a pretty well-trodden story, I think. But there were all of these technological advances that had been made during the war. We had better machines. We had new chemical technologies. And then, you know, the war stopped and the military stopped placing orders with those companies that had developed those new technologies. And the companies kind of had to pivot. And so they started building building on the tech infrastructure they had developed during the war and marketing them as agricultural technologies. And so this is kind of famously how nitrogen fertilizer came about.
Yeah, the bomb, the materials for bombs were turned into fertilizers, for example.
Basically. Yeah, basically. And at this time, the ag policy in the U.S. was still basically the supply management policy that had been introduced in 1933 by the Roosevelt administration, the Agricultural Adjustment Act.
Supply management was when we were having terrible prices for farmers, right? They couldn't, they kept, it had to do with the, well, explain it, Andrea.
Supply. It's always fun to talk about supply management policy, but man, it's so important. So supply management policy was comprised of two things. There were price supports on one hand, which was artificially high prices that the government guaranteed and some price floors, and then there were production controls on the other hand,
Right, we kept producing basically too much, and the price of grain kept going down and down and down and down and down. So the government stepped in to help farmers control how much they produce, so they were actually producing the amount that people actually needed. So
one of the stated goals of supply management policy was to reduce overproduction. But the structure
The initial impetus was quite healthy. But then what happened?
Well, there was this mismatch kind of built into the design of supply management policy from the beginning, where production control was based on acreage. So you were limited in the number of acres on which you could grow any given commodity and still qualify for those artificially high prices. But price supports were based on volume. So one was based on acreage, but the other was based on volume, which effectively incentivized farmers to grow as much as they possibly could on the limited acreage that still qualified for supply management supports, and the government was supporting this. So we were kind of like limping along that the government was dealing with, you know, paying to store the excess grain that it was obligated to buy. But then after the war, when we started using things like nitrogen fertilizers and yields really, really took off, right? Let's see, I think I have it in front of me. Yeah, between 1945 and 1970, U.S. corn productivity more than doubled. So this is the U.S., not Iowa. Mm-hmm. I think Iowa was even higher. But in 1945, the U.S. was averaging 33 bushels an acre of corn. And then in 1970, that more than doubled up to 72 bushels an acre.
Oh, my.
And under this whole period of, you know, skyrocketing yields, the government was obligated to keep buying the excess. And they, you know, kind of understandably were like, well, what are we going to do with all of this? We don't necessarily need all of this grain that we're buying. And in this post-war moment especially, right, this is, you know, leading into and in the Cold War, the idea that came up, the things that they landed on, was exporting it, particularly to developing countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And so in 1954, partially to deal with this excess, surplus of grain, the Eisenhower administration passed Public Law 480, or PL 480, which subsidized exports in the form of food aid around the world in order to try to promote economic development and provision inexpensive food and, you know, basically inculcate loyalty to capitalist systems over communist systems.
Loyalty. That's a very nice choice of words, Andrea.
It was tremendously effective. It was tremendously effective. By 1965, the United States was responsible for the vast majority of global food aid. And that narrative that we've been talking about, we feed the world, kind of came, you know, it came along with this idea that we were the benefactor of
how is this working out? How has the world been fed? I mean, it seems like there's people, we got problems, and people are still hungry. How come it hasn't worked?
Yeah, it's a very complicated question. And There's a couple of things we can talk about. So, you know, when we're talking about developing countries, agricultural systems, agrarian systems in particular, you know, I think it's not that surprising to think about the fact that a large amount of very cheap grain landing in a country, you know, kind of messed up, for lack of a more elegant word, the food systems there, and it would de-incentivize.
Right, it disrupted all the local markets.
Yeah,
sure.
It disrupted local markets and made it harder for local farmers to, you know, to be incentivized to grow food. You know, a really famous case that's been analyzed pretty extensively was Colombia. So the U.S. exported just a tremendous amount of wheat to Colombia in the 1950s and 1960s, and it made it so that people who had been growing things like potatoes and barley and other food crops in Colombia basically went out of production because they couldn't compete with this, you know, essentially dumping of cheap food. Folks who used to be smallholder peasants became marginally or unemployed after that. So that's one effect, right, is the kind of transformation of previously self-sufficient agrarian populations into consumers of commercial food. But Lana, it sounded like you were starting to get at some of the more like deeper assumptions of saying we feed the world and the idea of, you know, or the assumptions about where hunger even comes from.
Ah, that's an interesting one. Yes. Where does hunger come from? It seems like, where does poverty come from? Yeah. You wanted to ask about this, Donna.
Oh, right. In your paper, you used the word Malthusian, which I think is a wonderful word. Do you want to explain what Malthusian perspectives are and how it relates to this issue of hunger?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Yeah. So I use Malthusian or neo-Malthusian. That's a reference to the ongoing impact or influence of the ideas of a man named Thomas Malthus, who lived a very long time ago. He was born in the 18th century and was writing towards the end of the 18th, early 19th century in England. He was a cleric as well as an economist and, you know, scholar, writer. And he lived so long ago, but he's still really influential in the way that we think about what the causes of hunger are. He was kind of the originator of the overpopulation hypothesis, which he laid out in the 1798, I believe, book called An Essay on the Principle of Population. And, I mean, it's, you know, to really boil it down, probably to oversimplify it, you know, he was arguing that hunger was caused by overpopulation, that if we have too many people, there won't be enough food to go around. And so it's this idea that, that really obscures the role of things like inequitable distribution or poverty or, power flows in terms of deciding who does and doesn't get food, and just boiling it down to a really simple calculation of calories needed.
It is a little bizarre that we're still all kind of engaged in this fear factor of not having enough to eat, which is, you know, kind of the basis of We Feed the World, is make sure everybody has enough. The truth of the matter is there is more than enough food produced on the planet to feed not only the current population, but well into the future. Two things are happening that have proved it's not that we don't produce enough food, it's that we do not distribute it equitably. And also the other thing that's happening is some of the predictions from way back then to even, you know, the end of the 20th century are, of course, these huge population gains, which are proving to not necessarily happen. We, in many countries around the world, especially the first world nations, we're actually having population decline is now being projected. But we're still running on this fear of not having enough, and, you know, the moral certitude that comes from we are feeding the world. So what's going on here with the story? The underpinnings are a little shaky.
Yeah, that's a nice way of the moral certitude, Donna. I like that phrase. It's this like zombie story that just won't die, it seems like. And, you know, it's like, I get it, right? Like, it's a very intuitive explanation. Like, you know, too many people, not enough food. I think it's something that makes a lot of intuitive sense to folks, but people who have actually studied famines, who have actually studied hunger, and this is not to say, right, like that, you know, we have enough calories to feed everybody, like you said, but that's not at all to say that it's that hunger doesn't exist or that famine isn't a very, you know, real threat and reality. But it's just that framing it as a problem of globally available calories.
It's not a production problem. It's a distribution problem.
Yeah, it's really just like not quite hitting the nail on the head. So back in the, gosh, I think 1970s, there was a brilliant Indian economist named Amartya Sen who did a pretty thorough study of famines and showed exactly what you were just talking about, right? Like, hunger is caused by poverty. It's caused by inequitable food distribution. It's caused by war. It's not really caused by, you know, global shortages of calories. And so when you pull the bottom out of that, you know, explanation, the idea that we're feeding the world through always increasing our yields starts to feel like a little bit of a shakier justification or explanation.
Well, now, one thing that I'm concerned about, you know, when we kind of do this myth busting of we got to feed the world, you know, a lot of farmers who have been taught that and feel very strongly about that, and that's kind of like the moral imperative for the way that they farm. I'm concerned about them, that they are getting this sort of the fuzzy end of the lollipop, more or less, because what's happening is, you know, for a farmer, their greatest asset, their financial asset is their land that they own and the quality of the soil health. That is their financial asset. So this yield-driven short-term gain is not, in the long run, really good for their financial asset. You know, if you ruin your soils producing year after year high input, high fertilizer, and you disregard, you know, the long-term effects on the soil health and the environment of your farm at the cost of, you know, producing top yields, top dollar in the moment to pay for that expensive equipment, for example, this does not seem like a financially long-term viable thing that's really good for our Iowa commodity farmers.
I completely agree. I share that concern that you just voiced, Donna, and I think this is something else that kind of, you know, looking kind of critically at the narrative we feed the world can help illuminate, right? Because so we've been talking about how we feed the world is connected to and justifying and demanding in some ways increased yields. And when we start to look at who actually benefits from increased yields, we've just been saying it doesn't seem like it's, you know, like
it's Iowa corn
who
and
don't
soy
have
soy
enough
farmers.
Food.
Yeah.
Right. It's not people who are hungry around the world. You've just made a really good argument that it's not, you know, the long-term sustainability, viability, health of Iowa's commodity farmers. But if you're going to demand increasing yield, one thing you need to do is purchase a lot of inputs. And if you're going to produce a lot of commodities at the end of it, that keeps commodity prices pretty low. And the, you know, main purchaser of agro commodities are agribusiness processors who transform those commodities into finished products, like you listed at the beginning of the show, ethanol and livestock feed and processed food additives. And so having a large amount of, you know, cheap agro commodities is good for that group as well. And when I start to put those pieces together, that, I don't know, it helps me feel like I had a better understanding of one of the through lines, I guess.
Well, if I go back to this quote that we were talking about from the latest from Secretary Tom Vilsack, the coalition will launch productivity growth to promote the use of high-tech tools such as gene editing, precision agriculture, Okay, those are very large corporate interests. Those are not, this is not necessarily to the, I mean, they're selling things to farmers is what they're doing. And maybe this isn't the best, you know, this is a tricky question here in Iowa, but I just know that in terms of an investment, if you are constantly depleting your main asset, if you're running down the quality of your soils, if you're losing more to erosion, how can this be good for farmers?
Not good, I don't think. We have a justification that we tell ourselves. We justify yield on top of everything else.
It's like the treadmill of yield. Yield, yield, yield.
Yield is good, but that works on your bottom line. That does not necessarily work into what's on the plate for supper for a lot of people. I want to mention that this is KHOI and this is the Donalana Kitchen. I want to mention that you can find out more at khoifm.org. Find out more about this fine radio station and also find out more about our show. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking about how Iowa does or doesn't feed the world, but we sure talked about ourselves like we feed the world. And that concept, that narrative, says a lot about us. It justifies yields. And I want to deal a little bit with how this enters into politics and sustainability and the pride of being a farmer. Unfortunately, it's one of these, like we mentioned before, it's one of these hard concepts to face squarely and say, wait a minute, we don't feed the world. But it sure has a lot to do with farm subsidies and what farmers can get on a big scale, but it leaves out farmers that want to do other things. There are alternative ways of farming. There are sustainable ways of farming. And unfortunately, I'm afraid this pits farmer against farmer, the big guy against the little guy. Do you find things like that happening, Andrea?
In some ways, yeah. This was, you know, when I was in Iowa, when I was visiting farms across the state, like I said at the beginning, one of the first ways that I heard the narrative "We feed the world" was when often younger beginning type farmers who I was working with who were selling just to their local communities, you know, would be told sometimes really explicitly, "You can't feed the world farming like that." And then other times it was a more kind of subtle subtle judgment that it would work through, or they'd become aware of the fact that folks weren't taking, or they felt like, they told me that they felt like folks weren't taking their farm as seriously as they would maybe hope, because they weren't, you know, effectively engaged in these global supply chains, and that they weren't shipping their food around the world, that they were prioritizing feeding fellow Iowans and feeding their communities and their neighbors. And if the main story that Iowa Ag tells itself about itself is that we feed the world, and you're very intentionally opting out of that global orientation, it can, you know, I think it can create some friction. But then it also can go, you know, there's other ways of transforming the We Feed the World narrative. Something else I heard probably as often as I heard, you know, We Feed the World was, you can't feed the world feed corn, which points to what we were talking about earlier, that Iowa isn't really growing so much, you know, food crops.
That's true.
That kind of transformation, too.
Well, I'm a small-scale farmer myself. I grow vegetables on a small scale. And when I hear talk about farm markets and the market economy, it seems so far removed. There doesn't seem to be any, well, shall we say, the trickle-down of interest or support or even concern about sustainable agriculture, about doing things that, like Donna said, protect our soil. Instead of always going after yield, do you see there's any change in the feed the world narrative at all?
You know, I think it depends on what circles you're in. I think there's a lot of really smart, really engaged voices in Iowa and across the country, and certainly across the world, that are calling out that yield-centric accounting, that it, you know, is based on and, you know, furthers every time it's repeated, and saying, hey, maybe we shouldn't have yield be the primary determinant of who's considered a successful farmer, or have yield be the only yardstick, and we should start, you know, paying attention to other metrics, right? Mm-hmm. Like what we measure as a way to determine agricultural success really matters. And if we expand what we look at as ways to judge agricultural success away from just, you know, okay, but how much did you produce in one season, to also include things like, you know, I mean, anything from soil organic matter to earthworm counts to, you know, actual people fed or human edible calories produced, or, you know, how many people did you train in a new skill, or how many, how many pollinators did you feed, you know, like, because all of these other things we could be thinking about.
If
we decenter yields, which is happening, you know.
There are other metrics that, you know, that we haven't been counting for a long time. And it's also the other thing that this, you know, corn and soybean domination has caused is when you want to rebuild the local food system, we have lost our processing infrastructure. We only know how to, you know, get those soybeans and those corn kernels out of the field and to the grain elevators and onto the trains. And, you know, but if you want to produce, 25 acres of carrots, you don't really have a way to market it.
Yeah.
We have lost that in the last, oh golly, probably 75 years or so. The distribution and the secondary pieces beyond, even if the farmer grows it right now, there's no way to move it to market in any kind of quantity.
Right.
So this is feeding the world, corn and soybeans, has caused in Iowa specifically the loss of the infrastructure to really grow other things. And people who are working on, you know, local food systems, now we've come to the point, well, is the government going to step in and help rebuild these local food systems? I don't know.
I'll bring this up because, after all, I got this microphone in front of me. Then there's this little thing called climate change, where we've had one heck of a drought. And it's dealing with the weather It seems an awful burden to put on Iowa and the Midwest to feed the world when we are dealing with a global problem here. So I think, I don't know, the next few years, next century or so, well, we'll see, or maybe the next 10 years.
Well, let's hope that, you know, soil fertility and soil ability to retain water becomes a metric that is a little more, well, has a little more attention paid to it, I suppose, because here in Iowa, you know, our soil is our biggest asset. We do live in a place on the planet that has some of the best soils in the whole world. And if we are just burning it out and losing it to erosion and compaction with the current agricultural feed the world paradigm, what's going to happen? What's going to happen if we get a little bit more drought?
Yeah, a little bit more drought. A little bit more pregnant. A little bit more drought. Okay.
Just a little bit more drought.
Okay. A little bit more drought. Well, we
yeah, Lana. Sorry.
No, we need to cultivate our soils in ways that help with water retention, have better tilth, and most of those methods are not what this large industrial system promotes. We have brought about a lot of damage to the soils.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Andrew, what are you do you see for the future? Are you going to keep looking at this topic, or are there other agricultural,
some better stories,
anthropology stories that are a little more positive here as we wind up?
I mean, we've been talking a lot about this as a negative thing, but I do see positive things coming out of it, and the, you know, like resistance or pushback that it can invoke in folks as well. I'll talk about future projects in a second, but Lana, one of the things you said just a few minutes ago, I think is a good point that we haven't quite teased out yet. You know, saying we feed the world is also just that's a huge burden to put on farmers. And I think it's worth taking a step back and saying, you know, why do we think that one region, one state, like should be the breadbasket of the world? You know, it's helpful for me to look at it from a like slightly higher perspective and just think like to me that seems like kind of an insane proposition that you know, however many tens of thousands of farmers in Iowa would feed the world seems
concentration of power.
That's a big responsibility to lay at their feet, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely concentration of power, but also just a big burden. And so thinking about, you know, before the 1970s, developing countries were net exporters of food. And then after the kind of policy changes and tech changes that we talked about a little bit earlier, you know, they, as a group, really reversed course and became, there was a big deficit, basically, and they became net importers of food. So we know that other places around the world are efficient agricultural production. So thinking about, you know, opportunities for coalition building, you know, Donna, we talked a little bit before about the UN Global Food System Summit that's taking place this week and the voices that are and aren't being invited to be there. You know, there's a lot of opportunities, I think, for coalitions and recognizing that we need more voices at the table and more people in the room to think about how to diversify and make more resilient global agricultural systems in the face of climate change. Unsurprisingly, climate and agriculture is what I'm starting to pivot towards in my own research as well.
Well, it is interesting that this article that we were saying where the EU strategy, their farm-to-folk strategy, is now standing pretty clearly in opposition to the where they used to be our allies in this global agribusiness thing. Now they're switching towards the use of reducing fertilizers and pesticides and putting 25% of their farmland into organic production, because organic production does produce better soil quality and better environmental benefits.
Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom from farmers all over the world, all over the planet, and I'm always concerned when there are far-reaching decisions made by folks in power.
or the Bill Gates Foundation.
Oh, yeah. Now, wait a minute here.
For example.
You wonder how his garden did this year, you know? I mean, get out there and, you know, so, you know, it's an amazing thing. We live on this planet and it has been sustaining us for many, many years.
Yeah. And if we run out of, good land on this planet, the soil on Mars is not looking too good.
I mean,
I'm not going with Jeff Bezos up there, I have to tell you.
No, he can
leave me behind here.
I
want to take care of the soil that we do have here on the planet. It's not lost yet.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today, Andrew, because this kind of thing, it comes up all the time, Iowa Feeds the World. And thanks for helping us to put a little bit of perspective on
it. To examine that phrase and how we use it and what it is really doing to us. And
Thank you both so much for inviting me to be on the show.
And thank you for your work and doing all of this. So, yes, Andrea is a newer generation than Lana and I, so it's encouraging to us to see that this thought process is moving on. So thank you for your work.
Great.
Thank you. I've learned a lot from you both. It's really fun to get to chat with you.
Okay. Good. Thank you for being with us today. That was Dr. Andrea Reising, and she is an agricultural anthropologist, and she helped us understand how things work when we talk about Iowa Feeds the World. Yes, it is.
Yes, let's not let these phrases go unexamined.
Yes, we should. Since we talk about food here, I thought it was quite appropriate. Very good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you every Tuesday at noon and repeat it at 7 p.m. or go to www.khoifm.org. Find out more about this fine community radio station. We had music today by Al Murphy, an Iowa treasure, a fiddler from the eastern shore of Iowa, and his band Harvest Home. We'll go out with the Grand Valley Waltz. Thanks for joining us today. Support Community Radio. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.